Today's Taisho is case 96 in the Bienlu, the Hikigan Roku, the Blue Cliff Record. Case 96 is entitled Joshu's Three Turning Words. Main subject, Joshu, Jiaozhou, said, clay Buddhas cannot pass through water. Metal Buddhas cannot pass through a furnace. Wooden Buddhas cannot pass through fire. Secho's verse, clay Buddhas cannot pass through water. The divine light illuminates heaven and earth. Had Shinko not stood in the snow, many deceptions, many pretenses. Metal Buddhas cannot pass through a furnace. Men came to visit Shiko and found the warning notice on the board, but everywhere the gentle breezes. Wooden Buddhas cannot pass through fire. I always remember how the monk Hasoda broke down the oven of sacrifice whose god so long had bound himself. So I want to thank everybody for coming in person and online and sitting so well this morning, sitting in deep samadhi together, so purifying. This koan, if there was ever a koan for our time, I think this is the koan. Let me read it one more time. Jiaozhou said, clay Buddhas cannot pass through water. Metal Buddhas cannot pass through a furnace. Wooden Buddhas cannot pass through fire. So, this week has been notably crazy, right? Have followed events of the week, or the last week and a half. Many people thought our financial system was going to collapse. And I know many people, I myself am very close to retirement, and I know many people who have just retired, and they were monitoring their 401ks day after day and getting more and more frightened and depressed. And that's very understandable. I was worried myself, of course. So, we've been in a period of pretty great stability. I was born in 1955. And my father had served in the Navy in the war, and he had survived. His ship actually got sunk in the Pacific, but a small number of people on his cruiser survived. And my father never talked about the war. My uncle served in France during the war and saw apparently some really incredible fighting there. He never talked about the war. Like many people of my generation, I grew up in a time of great, really like prosperity, stability. It was just actually really like a lovely time to be alive, right? And, it's possible that that world is the world is changing, and the world I grew up in and the world most of us have been living in may be passing away. And we're sort of in this period where there's a lot of instability, and you know, really frightening things can happen to us, right? I don't know if you follow other events, you know, if you follow what's happening in our legal system, or you follow what's been happening with people who are not American citizens being deported. All of these events, you know, are frightening and challenging. And you know, we don't know where it will end, right? We don't know where any of this is going. It's unfamiliar territory. This is a good time to practice Zazen. You know, we have these events like on the macro level, where you know everything's been. For about 80 years, we haven't had a major conflict with another country. We have had relative peace. My grandparents were working people who had very minimal educations. You know, everybody in my generation of my family got to a university, quite wonderful time. All of this is, you know, shifting in ways that, you know, there's a lot of shadows on the edge of our world now. And you know, this is on the macro level. On the micro level, things are a little bit like that too, right? You know, I don't know if you're aware of this, but a couple of years ago, my wife was having some vision problems, so she went to an ophthalmologist and had her eyes examined. And he said, "Oh, you have cataracts. We have to remove your cataracts." And then they took the cataracts away, which was great. But then my wife was seeing double. So for about half a year, we thought the surgeon had made a mistake of some kind, or that there was a defect in the way the surgery had been performed. And we went from ophthalmologist to ophthalmologist, and finally we went to an ophthalmologist who said, "Well, have you had a brain scan?" And no, you know. So my wife had a brain scan, and it turned out that she had a brain tumor. So this is a really, this was like out of 2 weeks earlier, we would have, you know, when we were filling out paperwork, if they'd asked us about our general health, we would have said, "Oh, we're in excellent health," you know. And then, you know, there was a period where we weren't really sure. This was a serious operation. It took almost 8 hours. We weren't really sure if my wife would have her vision, and we weren't really sure if she would ever recover from the operation, right? And I've been through this a couple times. My brother, when he was pretty young, he was early 50s, had cancer, bone cancer. And you know, he was very athletic, very outgoing, very a funny guy. Really, I loved my brother, and I liked being with him. And then, you know, this, all of a sudden, it was just like out of the blue, this happened. And you know, a couple of years later, he died. So, you know, this is part of life. I mentioned last week that my, 2 weeks ago, that my sister, she has worked in a company that's closely associated with, the United States government, and she does all of this wonderful work, this development work in places, East Timor. She's been in Palestine. She's, you know, she does all of this work. And, you know, she, her entire unit has been phased out, right? And she's quite a bit younger than I am. And, but she's still, like, you know, in her late 40s. So she has, you know, that's challenging, very difficult. You know, when things like this happen, you know, we have like a natural reaction. And our natural reaction is defensive, right? It's defensive. When we're frightened, we, you know, close up. And that makes a lot of sense, actually, right? It makes a lot of sense. You know, when you're on guard, when you're expecting a blow, you become vigilant, you armor yourself, you know, your muscles tense up and so on. That makes sense, but in a way it's like the worst possible thing you can do, right? I have mentioned the fact that when I was young, we lived in Baltimore, Maryland, in the late 50s and early 60s. I was just a little kid, but in the 60s I was, starting to be like not an infant but a child, and I realized, you know, I was in a really difficult environment. Baltimore in the 1960s was tough place, very working class place. I used to have to walk to school, and I lived in an apartment complex, I'd have to walk through this area of Baltimore, which was a very segregated society. So, where I was living, there were virtually no people of color. And I had to walk through this area of Baltimore that was like white working class to get to my school. And the kids in that community were, you know, really tough, you know, kids. They fought all the time. There was a lot of physical, you know, at school there, I was relatively safe except on the playground. But, you know, when I would go to school and I would come back from school, I and my friends were always like in danger physically. And sometimes we would get beaten up. After a while, going to school filled me with such dread. It was like my brother had the same reaction. He actually would tell my mother he was sick so he didn't have to go to school, you know. He had like psychosomatic symptoms. He would throw up, you know, this sort of thing. So nobody likes being in a situation where you're completely out of control, right? That's a painful, difficult situation. And, when we're out of control, it makes total sense to try to get control, right? That makes so much sense. You're successful, you know, right? I mean, eventually my parents moved out of Baltimore. That solved my problem. And I never was in a situation like that again. I think I've carried that. The habits I created, the mental habits I created, I think I've carried forward in my life in many different ways. So you could say that was like an unresolved problem. And I was rescued from having to resolve it, but I carried it forward throughout my life. You know, I think a lot of my early life was dominated by those early experiences of being fearful and trying to avoid conflict, right? It was many years later in my Zen practice, things that I had completely forgotten about came up in my Zen practice. And I realized, you know, I've let myself be dominated or let my life be controlled by fear and anger, sense of helplessness and so on, that I never had a chance to resolve as a little kid. I just moved on and carried it all with me in a unexamined way. So you know, nobody likes being in situations where we don't have control, and it makes sense that we try to regain control. But you know, even if we regain control, we carry that sense of fear and the loss of control along with us if we don't resolve the problem in the proper way, right? You know, this is a time when things could get, you know, very challenging for us, and nobody wants to be here. I so wish that I so wish that Kamala Harris were the president right now. Things might be better, you know, but it's not the case, right? And we don't know where we're going. We see our civil liberties eroding around us, and so on. And again, it makes sense that we want to get control. You know, one of the lessons I think of Zen practice, of Dzogchen, of Zazen, is the futility of control, believe it or not, you know. If you do a little bit of meditation, you know, you start meditating, you become regular at it, you know, you can have a period of meditation where things are just going so badly, right? You sit on the cushion, you're distracted, your focus is poor. If you don't quit, you come back and the next day you do it again, and you can't get in the flow. And you know, but you keep, you persist, and one day you sit down on the cushion and it's just like magic, right? It's magic. If you've practiced long enough, I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. You have these experiences where you sit down on the cushion and it's like something just carries you forward and you feel so liberated, right? I think this is why if you've been practicing meditation and you have stuck with it for a while, these experiences happen. And when they do, they're so amazing. It's like, I don't know what just happened to me, but I'd like to have that happen more often, right? So you know, you might be struggling with your practice, and then you come in one day, and you sit down on the cushion, and it's just this, it's transport, right? It's like you're lifted out of yourself, and you're carried forward, and everything is unfolding. It's like the whole universe is unfolding with you. You know, and the sit ends, I ring the bell, you know, and, you know, next time you're looking forward to that experience and it doesn't happen again. And, you know, then, you know, you might go through another period of groping blindly in your practice. But sooner or later, you know, there's another moment where, you know, everything just seems to be carrying you forward in this beautiful way. You know, if you haven't had a chance to do sesshin, I very much hope you will have an opportunity to do sesshin. You know, we meditate for a number of days. You know, sometimes it's five, sometimes it's seven. And you know, people who come to sesshin have really made a strong commitment, right, to practice. That you've cut a week out of your schedule. You've cleared all of your calendar. You're going to come and meditate for a week. You're going to get up at, you know, 4:30 in the morning. That level of commitment is extraordinary in itself. You know, and what people often find is that they, you know, they have this high motivation. They come to sesshin, and you know, first day it's okay. You know, The second day, you're okay. Usually what happens to people around the third day, you know, suddenly you're really over your head, right? That's so much meditation. And you may find that, you know, there are lots of things that are going wrong now, you know. Your legs hurt, your back hurts, you feel like you can't focus. So a lot of people, you know, a lot of people who attend Sesshin have this experience where, you know, by around day three, they may regret coming, right? And if you ask them what they regret, they probably won't be able to tell you, but I think what they regret is this sense of, like, powerlessness, right? Powerlessness. You know, we're pretty good at controlling our lives, right? So, you know, we're pretty good at, I make sure to pay all my bills on time. You know, I really don't want to get in trouble, so I pay my bills on time, I pay the taxes on time. You know, I'm very good. If I'm in a city, I try to stay in places where I'll be safe, you know, and I won't get lost, and I won't have a recurrence of what I used to experience as a kid in Baltimore. So, you know, we're all pretty good at controlling things, right? We pace ourselves at work, you know. Maybe in the afternoon you get tired, so you always have a coffee break and you have some coffee. You know, you stay on top of your work so you're not blindsided. In the modern world, it's pretty easy for us from day to day to feel like we're in control. But, you know, when you go to Sesshin, around that day three, you suddenly feel very keenly that that this is out of your control, or that you're over your head, right? And you know, if you've been practicing meditation, you might have started the Sesshin feeling like you knew the routine, you know, but by around day three, it's like this experience of, like, just like over your head, like just. And I hope you come to Sesshin, and if you do, I beg you on the day three to stay and not jump in your car and drive away, because if you stay, it's the most amazing transformation. You know, when I first started teaching Zen, my teacher had authorized me to teach, but I didn't do it for a while. I didn't feel confident, and I finally started having sesshins at my house, just like five or six people. And Jim and Yen are part of the people who used to, Jaru, you know, used to come to my house and we'd do sesshin. And the first time we did sesshin, I think one of the first times, it was more than that, we had like maybe 8 or 10 people. And I was meeting them in what's called Dokusan, individual interviews with the teacher, private interview, at the end of the day. And people were coming in on day three and they were saying things like, I was saying, how's your practice? And they were so despondent, right? And I think somebody did say, I don't know, maybe I might leave tomorrow morning. It just seemed, I went to bed and I just thought, oh my God, I'm a total failure as a Zen teacher. And, you know, the next day, nobody left. And that evening when we had Dokusan, people came in and I said, how's it going? They said, oh, wonderful. You know? And people were, you know, they had their responses to their koans. And, you know, at the time I was, you know, just began. I thought, gee, I'm a brilliant Zen teacher, as it turns out, but I'm not. It's the process, right? It's the process. It's not false modesty. It's the process, right? People, you know, try to control. It's like every day of the sesshin gets a little more challenging, and people are able to, like, maintain the fiction of control. But by day three, you know, it's like you just can't. And that feeling of being out of control is so unpleasant. It's frightening, right? It's like, it might even feel like suffocating, right? But, you know, the lesson of the Dharma, the lesson of Zen, is that, you know, that's where liberation happens, right? That's where liberation happens. And that's where people connect to, like, this bigger life. It's like they connect. It's like that feeling, like, suddenly you're, it's like the whole universe is helping you, right? It's like everything is helping you wake up. That experience is not available so long as you are tightly controlling your life, right? It's when we have that experience of being totally out of control that it's like on day three of Sesshin, there's like a light switch that goes on in people's heads. And their heads were dark and now their heads are bright, right? And you can see it in people's faces. Their faces are transformed. You know, there's a kind of softness and brightness to their faces. And that doesn't mean when they sit down on the cushion, their legs don't hurt anymore. But they're now responding to all this in a different way. It's like they've emptied themselves out. And they've like given up trying to control things. And when you can't simply say, okay, I'm giving up, I'm not going to control things. But when circumstances push you beyond the limits of your ability to control, that's what happens, right? It's like you shift into this bigger mind. In Zen, we talk about the big mind, right? It's like the big mind, and now now you're not trying to protect yourself. Your relationship to everything around you is completely different.
Right.
You know, you don't have to be at Sesshin when this happens to you, right? You know, when I came to Rutgers, I was told by my department chair that if I didn't write a book in 5 years, I would be fired, basically. It was like, you have 5 years to write this book, and if you don't write it, you're out of here. He was really a nice guy. He was just being totally straight. He said, Rutgers you will be fired, right? So you must do this. And truth is that I wasn't well prepared for that. You know, I had written a dissertation that I couldn't use as a book. I had to write this book from scratch. And I had all of these responsibilities. So, you know, the chances of success were very small, as a matter of fact. And, you know, I was lucky enough to get a research leave to work on this new book project, you know. But I started right away undermining myself. You know, I started telling myself, oh man, the chances of this working out are zero, you know. And of course, when I told that to myself, I became depressed and fearful. I couldn't sleep. It was like waiting for the firing squad, right, you know. So, you know, luckily I had 10 years of Zen practice, you know. And I just would get up every morning and sit, you know, for X number of hours. And then I would write. And, you know, the thing is that it was absolutely hopeless situation, right? It was like, once I gave up on hope, you know, actually things got so much better, you know? It was like I would just meditate and then I would write. And, you know, writing wasn't being, my goal in writing really stopped being to survive, right? It was like I, on some level, I just sort of gave up. Every day I would sit, I would write. In the afternoon, I would go for a jog because I'd been writing for 8 hours and my back hurt. And, you know, sometimes I'd come home and I'd write again, right? But I would get up every morning and do my zazen. And, you know, I just realized this is, whether this works or not, doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. I'm just going to give myself over to this process. It's like, this is my practice. I'm doing my zazen on the cushion, and now writing is my practice off the cushion, right? And I can't, you can't order yourself to be brilliant. You can't order yourself to be original. You know, you can't order yourself to be clear. You just have to start writing. And, you know, writing is itself this mysterious process, right? And, you know, if you are trying to write something that's brilliant, or you're trying to write something that's original, you create an insurmountable obstacle for yourself. If you turn your writing into a practice, right? It's just like meditation. You can't control your meditation. You can't say, oh, I had a great sit yesterday, I'm really going to have a great sit today. You can't sit down on the cushion and say, today I'm really going to be focused. Nothing's going to get in my way. As soon as you do that, you can be sure your mind is going to be like a beehive of thoughts. You know, what happens with Zen practice is, you know, we fail, and we fail, and we fail, and we fail. You know, I can't tell you, I did koan practice with two different shifu, two different teachers. And I can't tell you how many times I went into the Dokusan room and had my answer was rejected. And I went through all of the at first I was crushed. My feelings were hurt, you know, especially when I started doing Zen. I was so hoping that I had like an aptitude for this. I had a fantasy that, you know, when I first started doing meditation practice, I actually had like these fantasies. I was going to meet this monk who was my teacher, and he was going to go, oh, you're the reincarnation of my old teacher. I'm so glad to meet you. You know, thank God I found you after all these years. Instead, I was just this guy who couldn't answer. I couldn't get anywhere with my practice. And it was just like every other kind of failure. You know, I'd meditate. I'd try. I'd go into the Dokusan room and in a classic temple style, they just ring the bell. It's like I wouldn't even get through my answer. Like, next, you know. And this went on and on, right? And it was like, it was so... At first it was something I could just say, well, you know, I'm sure I'll get the answer. And then as time went on and I'm investing more and more time in my practice and getting nothing out of it, right? I'm putting in energy, but no return. You know, at various points I thought about quitting, but then there was just something about Buddhism, about Zen, that was so liberating. And I didn't know what it was, but it was the failure, actually. It was this may sound crazy, but it was the failure. You know, I would go in to see the teacher and I would be rejected right away. And I would go back to the cushion and I tried everything. I wrote poetry. You know, the thing is, I just kept failing and failing and failing. And actually, failing is so purifying. It's like it purifies body, mind, and word. It purifies your being. Now, this is like, this sounds so crazy, because everything in modern culture is about success, right? I mean, the word success is, you know, probably the most important word, right? So if you say he is a very successful man, everybody just thinks, oh, I so want to be successful. If you say, oh, he's a complete failure, people, you know, leave a lot of space around him, you know. But actually, people who are genuinely successful have been big failures. That's I think people who have made real contributions, right? Real contributions, have done things that are really contributions, weren't afraid of failure. They actually understood that you fail your way to some kind of an insight. I was just listening to this interview with a novelist I like on NPR yesterday, and she said, "Yeah, for the first 20 years of my life, you know, I just kept getting rejected." And she said, "And I would, you know, I would write from like 5 a.m. until noon, and then I had this. I was a waitress for like, you know, I was a waitress for 15 years." And she said, "My teacher told me, you know, don't be afraid of failure." She said, "Just persist." She said, "What really happens is people quit. They quit on themselves, right? They don't stick with it. They just quit on themselves." And she said, "The ones who don't quit, sooner or later, it's like they catch the wave, right? They catch the wave, or the wave catches them." And that's, if you know anything about people who are creative, you know, this is so, you can't make yourself creative. You just have to put yourself into positions where you're out of control, and you have to trust the process to reveal something to you. See? So, you know, for me, I had no choice. You know, I was in a very bad situation. I didn't have much time. You know, I luckily had this year off of research leave where I could write this book. But, you know, people spend 5 years writing a book. Six, you know, I had a year is really not much to go from draft to finished product. But I turned it into, you know, every day I would do my Zazen, and then it's like, what is going to happen is going to happen, but I'm going to make myself available to the universe, right? And this is the way people wake up in their practice. It's the best way to live your life, right? It's you know, control is, you know, one of the things that Buddhists like to talk about is interbeing. If you know anything about Thich Nhat Hanh, the wonderful, wonderful Zen teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, one of the things Thich Nhat Hanh used to teach was, we aren't individuals, we're all interconnected, see. And that sounds wonderful. And, you know, we're not alone. We're not alone. We're in a web of relationships. We're all connected. And that sounds wonderful. Interbeing sounds great, but actually think about it, right? Think about interbeing. We're all connected, but think of who you're connected with, you know? You're connected with Trump. You're, you know, in other words, you know, interconnection is a nice idea until you realize that there are 8.5 billion people on the planet, right? Or you realize that, you know, there's, when you begin to go outward from yourself and you start tracing out those connections, you realize how little control anybody really has. And, you know, you can say to yourself, you can get deeply depressed about this, but actually that doesn't change anything, right? It doesn't change anything. And it's not a fantasy. You really are interconnected. Like the economy, right? The economy is this global system that nobody can figure out. You know, you could be very smart. You could read the stock, you know, stock news every day, but you know, you could still lose $500,000 in a crash. You know, if we begin to realize that control is very limited, it's a kind of story we tell ourselves, that it's useful sometimes, but that for the most part, it actually prevents us from being awake and alert. there's a kind of fear mentality behind the desire for control. And that fear makes us unintelligent and unobservant, right? So like Zen practice is, you go in to see your teacher, you don't get the answer, you don't get the answer, you don't get the answer, and then finally you just give up, right? You say, well, I'm either going to leave Zen or I'm just going to keep practicing and I may never answer my koan. And then you're sitting and all of a sudden you realize that, your whole body is disappearing. It's not what you expected, it's just what's happening. You're sitting on the cushion and it feels like your body is gone. And, people will come into the Dokusan room and I'll say, how's it going with your koan? And they'll say, oh, terrible. And I'll say, well, what's happening on the cushion? And, nothing. And I'll say, well, just tell me what's happening. And somebody will say, well, a funny thing, this morning I felt like I completely disappeared on the cushion. It's like, oh, wonderful. That's wonder. What a wonderful response to your koan. So people don't even recognize what they have just stumbled into because their presuppositions are blinding them to what just happened to them. So the point is that, when we try to control things, we actually create a lot of obstacles for ourselves. And I'm not saying you shouldn't pay your bills on time, but there's a way of going through the day which is based upon not caring. You could say not caring. I can't control this. Everything is helping me wake up. See, everything is helping me wake up. That's how I got through my book. I would just think, everything is helping me wake up. And just if you live in that spirit, if you stop trying to control things and you live in that spirit, everything becomes your ally. Everything becomes your ally. It's like we can't make use of the things that happen in our lives because we're pushing them away out of fear. And, when we stop reacting fearfully, when we give up, don't fight. If somebody said, what is Buddhism all about? I would say, don't fight. Right? It's about don't fight. As soon as you feel yourself creating a wall, like you're clenching up, you're protecting yourself. It's defensive, closing yourself off. It's a natural human response, but it's actually the worst thing you can do. See, you need to lean into what's happening. Become one with what's happening. Right? That's always the secret, right? So if we go back to this koan, right? Zhaozhou was maybe the greatest Chan master of the Tang Dynasty. Maybe the greatest. He was the one who came up with the Wu, the Mu koan. Main subject, Zhaozhou said, clay Buddhas cannot pass through water. Metal Buddhas cannot pass through a furnace. Wooden Buddhas cannot pass through fire. So, if you're working on this koan, there's really like four turning words instead of one, right? Water, furnace, fire, right? Those are, I don't know what your water is, but I have a water that, I have a water that's an obstacle. Sometimes when I sit in deep meditation, my mind is filled with the image of clear water. It's just like pure, clear water. It comes to me all the time when I'm meditating. When I'm in deep samadhi, it's like I'll suddenly realize my mind, I can actually visualize like water. It's either like a stream or it's clear. My mind is like clear water, but you know, at various times in my life, you know, I used to have a dream when I was running this academic unit, and there was something that was always going wrong. I used to have this recurring dream where water was coming through the I'd go up into the attic of my house, and the attic was vast in my dream. This is like a recurring dream. I'd go up to the attic of my house, and the attic was vast, and the water was leaking through the roof all over. And I would have this thought, I can't stop this from happening. See, this is like classic anxiety dream, right? I can't control this. You know, water is lawless. It doesn't respect our boundaries. It, you know, it's coming through the ceiling, see. That's my water, right? You have your water too, right? We all have our furnace, right? We all have our fire. But the most important word in this koan is phrase is pass through. You can't defeat fire. You can't defeat the furnace. You can't defeat, see, you have to let it dissolve you. You have to let yourself be dissolved. You have to let yourself be dissolved by what's happening. Don't pull away, become one with. You know, this is a basic lesson of, this is Chan 101, Zen 101. You know, if you start meditating, you begin to have pain in your legs. And if you are worried about pain in your legs, the pain just gets worse and worse, right? You know, you'll stop sitting eventually if you worry too much about it. You know, what happens to a lot of people is they reach a point, maybe they're sitting for a day or they're at a sesshin, and the pain is just like, all of a sudden they say, you know, fine, I will just be with this pain. And, you know, it's like a miracle. Right? I remember when this happened to me, I went in to see my shifu because we were at a sesshin, and my legs have been hurting me day after day. And I didn't say consciously, I accept this pain. I just sort of thought, screw it, you know, this is never going to be solved. Forget it. And it was like a miracle. I went in and I saw him and I said, I can't believe it. For the last couple of hours, I've been sitting without pain. And you know what had happened was, I just let there be pain. Right? Pain is part of living. You know. Part of living, you know. If you do this, you're going to have pain. If you do this, you're going to have pain. There's nothing in life that doesn't produce some pain. And you know, it's like once I just said, okay, I'm going to be in pain, I have this long period of like painless sitting. It came back. You know, I've been sitting for 50 years. I still have pain in my legs. I do the same thing. It's just, okay, there'll be pain. And I'm lifted up and carried forward into this deeper state of consciousness. Yeah? And if there is pain, I can't hear it screaming in my ear anymore. It's very remote, right? Or it just goes away. So you know, Jiaozhou is like this Zen genius, in my opinion. This, you know, the Mu Koan, the Wuxin Koan is so important, the emptiness koan. But this koan is also so important. The things that frighten us, that hurt us, you know, we want to pull back from them, but don't do it. Becoming one, pass through. How do you pass through? You become one with, right? So you say, okay, I'm not going to get tenure. This book is going to be terrible. I'm still going to do it. Every day I'm going to get up and do my zazen, and I'm going to write this book, and it's my practice, right? I'm going to do it with my whole heart and not judge myself, right? But just do it. It's like my offering to the universe. I'm going to express my trust, right? Trust. You know, we talk about this, the trusting mind. You know, one with the trusting mind. This is all about becoming one with whatever is happening. So, you know, if the stock market goes down the tubes tomorrow, you know, or Monday, you can get very upset, but it doesn't change anything. It prevents you from responding creatively to the situation, right? You just have to say, you know, I am one with this right now, right? If, you know, I am one with this. Oh, sorry. That's my clock. Main subject, Joshu said, clay Buddhas cannot pass through water, metal Buddhas cannot pass through a furnace, wooden Buddhas cannot pass through fire. Secho's verse, pass through, is the turning phrase. Clay Buddhas cannot pass through water. When they are dissolved, what happens? The divine light illuminates heaven and earth. Had Shinko not stood in the snow, many deceptions, many pretenses. So Shinko is the Japanese for Wike. That is Damo's first student. Right? So when he came to see Damo living in a cave, Damo wouldn't let him in. And he stood in the snow waiting for Bodhidharma to let him into the cave. See, so he stopped, he put aside all his expectations, right? And he just waited and trust. And the next day, Bodhidharma came out of the cave and said, his lay name was Shengguang. He said, Shengguang, come in, see, come in. But if he had left, if he'd gotten discouraged, if he hadn't trusted the process, he'd have quit. So he let himself be dissolved in the snow. Metal Buddhas cannot pass through a furnace. Men came to visit Shiko and found the warning notice on the board, but everywhere the gentle breeze. These are stories from Chinese history and mythology. Wooden Buddhas cannot pass through fire. I always remember how the monk Hasoda broke down the oven of sacrifice whose god so long had bound himself. He set free the kitchen hearth god by breaking down the altar. So, you know, whatever challenges life is going to hand us in the days and months ahead, you know, we have a superpower. Right? And our superpower is the trusting mind, right? It's whatever, I am one with this. I am always one with this.